We spent a good bit of time in the Gospel of Matthew, so we're now ready to move to the Gospel of Luke. I remind you that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have some interrelationship. It is believed, and I support this approach, that Mark was first, because both Matthew and Luke use Mark almost in entirety. It's kind of like the core of Matthew and the core of Luke comes from Mark. So if Mark comes first, you've got Matthew and Luke coming later as written Gospels. Matthew and Luke have some material in common, and that is simply referred to as the Q source. Q for quell, Q-U-E-L-L-E, which is the word for source. It's an unknown source, but it is believed that there was a source of material that Matthew and Luke drew upon because they've got it in common. It's not in Mark. But Luke has material that Matthew and Mark do not have. So it's the L source. Matthew has a source that Luke did not have and Mark did not have. We call that the M source. So simply know that Luke is a final editing of materials that have pre-existed. Coming from the time of Jesus, there was an oral tradition telling the story, interpreting that, and then it began to be written down, and in different communities there were different parts and pieces and so forth. And that's why I talk about these sources that are brought together by Luke to comprise his written gospel. Now, Luke uses Mark differently than Matthew does. Luke follows Mark's order much more closely. He tends to eliminate anything that is double, anything that is extra. He's a sleek writer. He's a slimming down writer. He seems to get to the point when he's got prior material, much more than Matthew. In fact, for example, the feeding of the thousands, Matthew increases the number of that, but there are multiple feedings, and Luke reduces it down. He's the best Greek writer of the three, and perhaps throughout the entire New Testament. He is a very accomplished, educated, eloquent Greek writer, and his use of the language far exceeds that of the other gospel writers. Now, his work has a more biographical feel to it, more of a telling the story of Jesus feel to it. You remember we talked about Matthew has five discourse sections, probably representing the Torah. And in between the discourse sections or teaching sections, there's narrative, storytelling about the life of Jesus. Well, Luke sort of blends it so much more. He does not break it into a discourse section, then a narrative section, a discourse section, a narrative section, like Matthew does. He blends it. So it's more of a biographical sense that you get when you're reading the Gospel of Luke. Now, of course, there are parts of Luke that you do not have elsewhere, and what you've got in Matthew, for example, you do not find in Luke. For example, Matthew's Gospel has a Sermon on the Mount. Luke does not have that. Although he does have what is called Sermon on the Plain. Not airplane, but P-L-A-I-N, the Sermon on the Plain. In fact, I'll take you there, chapter 6 of Luke's Gospel. Go to 17. 6:17. You remember in Matthew's Gospel it says he went up to the mountain and he began to teach? Okay, keep that in mind. In Luke it says he came down with them and stood on a level place. That's why it's called Sermon on the Plain. With a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people and so forth, healed their diseases, etc., etc. And then he looked up to his disciples, verse 20, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry." Now, see, it reminds you of the Beatitudes of the Sermon on the Mount. But he then has that, just on that little brief part, and then he has the woes. "Woe to you when you're rich, for you've received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry." This is not the Sermon on the Mount. This is something different. This is one of the unique contributions that Luke makes. The parable of the virgins, the parable of the sheep and the goats, you don't have that anywhere else. The number of stories of the Galilean appearances of the risen Lord, you do not have elsewhere. So Luke makes a number of significant contributions to the portrayal of Jesus. It's extremely important that you know that Luke wrote two volumes that are in the New Testament. One is the Gospel and one is what we know as the Book of Acts. They're separated by John because you've got to put the four Gospels together, and you put the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then John. But if you would take Luke as the Gospel and Luke's Book of Acts and put them side by side, or end to end, you would see that it just naturally flows. When you read the end of Luke's Gospel and the beginning of the Book of Acts, it just flows. And that is because it's a two-volume work that the author has provided. When you put them together, there are a total of 52 chapters, which is a full one-fourth of the New Testament. We always think of Paul having that big corpus, which is true. Paul has the bulk of the New Testament. But you put Luke's work, Luke's Gospel and Luke's Acts together, you've got a significant portion of the New Testament. But when you separate them the way we do, and you're not aware that it's the same author behind both of them, you get this sense that Luke has got, you know, pretty regular sized gospel, and then the Book of Acts. You know, you don't see it, but when you put them together, you will see it. It is because as Luke opens his gospel, if you go to 1:1, he says that many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down, and so forth. Go to verse 3. "I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account." Another way of interpreting that, it's not just orderly, in order. It actually is a complete account, or a full account, that he's referring to. And so he's covering a period of about 60 years, perhaps, when you think about Luke Acts. In other words, Jesus and the church. It's about a 60-year period. And so to give an orderly account or a complete full account, you're going to take up a lot of pages and a lot of chapters. And that's one of the reasons for the Lent. It is not that he's wordy. It's not that he stretches things out. Matthew does that more. As I said, he's very concise. He's very slim and sleek as a writer. Very eloquent. But there's just so much ground to cover. And particularly if you're doing it in a more of a biographical way. And you think about it. Think about the Book of Acts. Very, very much historical. Very much telling the story of the church and the events that happened. Okay. If anybody needs an outline, I've got some here. In fact, come here for. In the prologue, and by the way, there is a prologue to the Gospel and a prologue to the Book of Acts. That's just the style of Luke. In the prologue to the Gospel, he mentions Theophilus. The name Theophilus means God lover. Now think about that. Theos, God. And Philos, Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. It's the lover of God. That's what Theophilus means. We do not know who Theophilus was. We do not know if he was an actual figure or more of a character that represents something. Maybe some group of believers or whatever. There is a debate about who Theophilus may or may not have been. But Luke is addressing the gospel to him and calls him most excellent. That's an honorific title which is given to someone who may have some standing socially, politically. And he must be wealthy because the indication here is that he's the patron supporting the work of the writer. But again, we still do not know who Theophilus is. But obviously some significant connection here, if indeed he is the case. If he is an actual figure, he's a member of the Christian movement. In other words, in verse 4, the things of which you've been informed or instructed. In other words, you've already been told these things. I'm now writing them down in an orderly fashion. According to the superscription, in other words, if you open your Bible, it says the gospel according to Luke. That's the superscription. And according to tradition, Luke was a physician, co-worker of Paul, mentioned two or three times by Paul in his writings. You've heard that, haven't you? That Luke was a doctor. However, there is no evidence whatsoever for that. None. Internally in the gospel itself, or in the New Testament, or externally. What I mean by externally is other historical sources. Maybe in the very earliest part of the church, some of the church fathers saying something. Now, the tradition started early, but there is no evidence that Luke was a physician, or any evidence that it was the Luke to which Paul refers to who was a physician. In other words, we just don't know. In fact, this gospel is considered the latest of the synoptics in the late first century, and some scholars would even date it in the second century, which was too late for Luke, the physician. So if you use that as evidence, you'd have to say, well, it's not that Luke that Paul was working with. We're not quite sure who the author is. The audience is predominantly Gentile. Again, this writer is highly sophisticated in his use of the Greek language. And so would be his readers. There are other evidences, his indication of an appreciation for the Gentiles. He's not as Jewish as Matthew. Remember, Matthew is formed his writing around the Torah, the structure of it, the content of it. Jesus is the true messianic interpreter of the Torah. You don't have any of that in Luke, none whatsoever. And particularly with the book of Acts put beside the gospel, Luke is interested in the Gentile mission. He quickly picks up with Paul and quickly picks up with the Gentile mission. So, his audience is predominantly Gentile, I can put it that way. If you notice in the Gospel, immediately Jesus starts moving toward Jerusalem in Luke's Gospel. In Matthew and Mark, you have more of half the Gospel, Jesus is in Galilee, but then sets his sight toward Jerusalem. And in Mark's Gospel, it's almost halfway in chapter 8. On the way to Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus says, who do people say that I am? That sort of wraps up the first half of Mark's Gospel. And then he sets his sight toward Jerusalem, and the Son of Man must be crucified, and etc., and makes his way. And then has the triumphal entry, the crucifixion, whatever. In Luke's Gospel, Jesus starts moving toward Jerusalem right away. In fact, think about this. When he is presented by his parents in the temple, he already is in Jerusalem. In a sense, he never leaves. Though he lives in Nazareth, when he begins his ministry, it is in and out and around Jerusalem, much more than Galilee, which is removed from Jerusalem. In the book of Acts, the movement is not toward Jerusalem, it's from Jerusalem out, beyond. So I think Luke sets it up purposely this way.
He would have, as growing up, he would have visited Jerusalem like annually or for.
Not all Jews did that because they couldn't afford it, or couldn't make the trip because of health or whatever. But it wasn't uncommon, and we do have here. The only story we have of Jesus' childhood, which is his parents make a visit to Jerusalem and he's left behind or stays behind or gets separated. And they find him in the temple. So, you know, the presentation of Jesus being there when he's a child, those kind of things. It's so important for Luke to have Jesus' ministry in and toward Jerusalem, but then in Acts to have the church's ministry in and away from Jerusalem. It's an interesting movement pattern that Luke lays out here. Luke is known for his conception birth narratives. Only other gospel, the only other place you have any story of Jesus' birth is Matthew. But you really don't have the story of his birth. You don't have the story of his conception in Matthew's gospel. You only have it in Luke. Mark has nothing related to anything of Jesus' beginning. Neither does John. Only Matthew and Luke. But think about it. In Matthew's gospel, it is focused on Joseph for purposes of genealogy. And only that an angel came to him and spoke and said, you need to take her as your wife and you will call him Jesus. Basically, you're going to adopt him. He'll be your son, which is extremely important for Matthew. And you jump over to probably when he was two or younger and Herod puts out the decree to kill the boys, the Jewish boys that are two and under, so as to hopefully destroy all possibilities of a king of the Jews. You do not have a conception narrative, you don't have a birth narrative, or anything like that in Matthew's gospel. Just the angel's visitation with Joseph and King Herod and the Magi and Joseph fleeing with the family to Egypt and that kind of thing. In Luke, however, you've got this lengthy conception and birth narrative. Chapters 1 and 2. I mean, it's lengthy. It's just amazing how much is provided here for us. And in the book of Acts, we're told about the conception and birth of the church. They were in the upper room, about 120 of them. At the end of the Gospel of Luke, they were told to wait until the Spirit came upon them. And then at Pentecost, the Spirit came and the church was delivered, birthed into the world. It's a birth narrative, a conception and birth narrative of the church, just as you've got it with the Gospel of Jesus. That's why many think he was an OBGYN. Physician. He's interested in obstetrics and that kind of thing. I'll talk a little bit later what I think Luke is really interested in, but I don't think he's interested in this kind of biological, physical kinds of conception and delivery. What he's focused on is, wait a minute, God has conceived this one and God has conceived the church. and he tells the story of each in one of his writings. Luke focuses on Mary for theological reasons, not gynecological, not obstetrical, not genealogical. It's theological, spiritual reasons that he focuses on Mary. And not just Mary, but Zechariah and Elizabeth are featured heavily in that first part. And it's not just Jesus' birth that is of significance to Luke. It's John's birth that is significant. So you got two conceptions, two births, two families, although they're kin. You've got all of this playing there in the opening of Luke's gospel. We're thankful to Luke for providing us with these stories. Particularly, what else would we read on Christmas Eve if we don't read Luke 2? We wouldn't have anything that tells the story so concisely as Luke provides for us in 20 verses in Luke 2. Now, there is no opening identification of Jesus in Luke's gospel as we found in Mark and Matthew. You remember? In Mark's gospel, you just immediately open up the Christ. And in Mark and Matthew's gospel, you immediately open up the Christ. You know, you immediately go into Son of Abraham, those kinds of things. But you do not have any of that. Theophilus, I'm writing an orderly account for you. Thank you for your patronage. And in the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. He just launches right into the story. Well, who's Jesus? We're interested in Christology. Well, we don't know right away. He doesn't make a little signature statement in the opening verse as the other two writers do. He is interested, as I've indicated, in the beginnings. He's interested in the beginnings of Jesus and the beginning of the ministry of the church. There are two childhood incidents that Luke provides us some insight on. Both feature Jesus in the temple. I've already indicated that. What is interesting, if you'll go to chapter 2, in chapter 2, verse 21, Jesus is named, he's circumcised, and then he is taken to be presented in the temple. Go down to 39. When they had finished everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own town of Nazareth. And here's the verse I'm interested in, verse 40. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Let me repeat that. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Go down to 52. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in years and in divine and human favor. It's the same ending. So think about it this way. The story of the naming, circumcision, presentation of Jesus in the temple. He grew in stature and wisdom and favor with God and man. And then at early teen years or pre-adolescent, age 12 or so, he's in the temple talking with the learned scholars when his parents find him. And he says, I must be about my father's business. And then it says, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in years and in divine and human favor. Luke is using that refrain at the end of each of the stories of Jesus in the temple. He's just wanting us to know that there's something about this one. Now, it's been proclaimed by angels, and it's been proclaimed by the faithful. The shepherds who went, they glorified and praised God. And Mary pondered these things in her heart. And by the way, it says it again here in 51. His mother treasured all these things in her heart. This is letting you know that there's the end of a little story here that's extremely significant. So not only angels, not only the faithful, but it would include Simeon and Anna in the temple and that kind of thing. It's just indicating not yet who he is totally, except as he's been proclaimed. He will now have to act it out. He will now have to live it out. And that would be the story of Luke. Another way to put it would be, in the book of Acts, it is told that the church is given the power to come alive and to speak. And then it'd be like a little refrain would be, and then the church grew in wisdom, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, it actually, Luke does that. He says, right after, remember after Peter's sermon, then on Pentecost, Luke makes the statement that they were all gathered together, worshiping, they had all things in common, those kind of. That is the same thing. Now they will have to live it out as the church. What it's saying is, all is working. All is together. Jesus is increasing. Jesus is in favor with God and humankind. The church is as well. The church is increasing in favor with both God and humankind. That's Luke's style as he opens up these narratives.
Is that saying that they're in God's will? Or is that...
Yeah, that'd be a way of putting it. Yeah. It's not just the little boy grew up. Man, you know, I used to know him when he was knee-high to a grasshopper, and here he is just growing on up, and he's getting smart. He's really smart as a whip. And you know, that's not what it's talking about. What it's talking about is this guy is growing up in the right way. And so when you talk about the church is starting out and beginning growing up in the right way, in the will of God. And the will of God for the world.
Is there a conflict in this story and the previous ones? Because they're talking about when after they presented him in the temple, they took him back to Galilee. Now, previous, in Matthew, I believe it was, said they took him to, came out of Egypt.
Well, that would have been when, in Matthew's gospel, it would have been when Jesus would have been two and under. And they took him, evidently, from Bethlehem to Egypt to escape Herod's massacre. And then came back, you know, to Nazareth, to Galilee, and so forth. But that would have been much younger. Whereas this one here, you're talking about the story of their boy in the temple?
Well, no, this is talking about in 39. And when they performed everything according to the law, they returned to Galilee to their own city, Nazareth.
They, as you can tell, Luke has nothing about the Egyptian exile or the Egyptian escape. He has nothing about that. Now, he could have, I guess, if he had known about it, and I would assume if, he may not have had that material from Matthew, but that still would have been with Jesus at age two or so, where Matthew could have, you know, they could have. Yeah, I mean, it's just that the writers have different material. But you're right. It doesn't. If you try to. There used to be a guy named Robertson who tried to harmonize the Gospels. They all fit, even though each one has different pieces. You can put them all together. Well, you've just uncovered one you can't fit.
Right.
Good observation.
I think what he's getting at is he's aware that that's where they're originally from, so that's where they're going back to. He doesn't have to be aware of the Egyptian period to know that. And that.
Right. Yeah, but if he's presented, the eighth day was the day of naming and circumcision and whatever, and so if he's there, if he is there on that, then they did not go back to Bethlehem. They did not go to Egypt. Whereas Matthew seems to indicate that they were still in Bethlehem. Otherwise, why would they leave if Herod's trying to kill all who are in Bethlehem? You see. I thought you were talking first about the one of the boy Jesus in the temple. But I see what you're talking about, right? It just doesn't fit. That's what makes it so interesting, though, when you study this, is to realize the what these gospel writers worked with and what they presented. Now, Jesus is not an interpreter of the Torah here as he is in Matthew's gospel. There are no citations from the Old Testament. There are no lengthy discourse sections. But neither is Jesus an apocalyptic agent as he was or as he is in Mark's gospel. He is not a nationalistic Messiah. He's not a political Messiah. I'm not saying he is for Mark, but Mark tends to have this idea that there's a crisis going on because you just put Jesus into the world and the apocalypse begins. And it's stirring not only the unclean spirits and the demons, but it's stirring the unclean powers of Rome and so forth. And so you get this idea that there's this apocalyptic agency, this political messianic kind of thing going on there. You don't have any of that in Luke's gospel. None whatsoever. In fact, Luke is known to have a very optimistic attitude toward the world and toward the Roman government. If you lay these gospels side by side, whenever some mention is made of Rome or the government, it's more positive here in Luke. You don't have that kind of weighty negative perspective that you would have in the other gospels. Luke does not stress the world's sinfulness. You know, this age is passing away and it's doomed. Don't have any of that. Even in the crucifixion of Jesus, the role of the Romans is downplayed. It's not removed, but it's not emphasized as it is in the other gospel writers. Luke is interested not in Jesus in relation to the Torah, and not in Jesus in relation to an apocalyptic crisis that was expected, but Jesus in relation to the entire world. There's a universality to Jesus in Luke's gospel. Luke is interested in Jesus and all humankind, not just Jesus and the Jews, and not even just Jesus and the Gentiles, but the Gentiles represent all humankind, the nations, and that's what Luke is primarily interested in. If you'll notice, let's go to his genealogy in chapter 3. What other gospel presents a genealogy of Jesus? Matthew. And you remember that it starts with whom in Matthew's gospel?
Abraham.
And goes to Joseph, Jesus' adoptive father. Here it starts with Joseph and goes back and doesn't stop with Abraham. And of course, it's not nearly as complete either. You know, Matthew gives the threefold, 14 generations kind of thing. But notice in verse 38, it goes all the way back to Adam and beyond to God. You follow me? Matthew starts in the past with Abraham and comes forward. Luke starts with Joseph and goes back, does not stop at Abraham, but goes all the way to Adam, but does not stop with Adam, goes all the way to God. And so, you know that for Luke, Jesus is Son of God. That's the point. In Matthew, he was son of Abraham. Now, if Luke had stopped with Adam, you would simply say, this descendant is the son of Adam. But because Luke adds Son of God at the end, in other words, Adam is the son of God, you push it even beyond humankind to God. And so, if you flip this genealogy in Luke, we'll start God, the Son of God is Adam, and so forth and so on. until Jesus. And Jesus is the son of where it starts. Now, he's the son of, along the way, he's the son of Abraham, he's the son of David, but ultimately, where it starts is the Son of God, or with God, and then he's the Son of God. So that gives us a clue as to what he's interested in. Now, Luke is also, as I indicated, not negative on the Romans as much. In fact, he sets what is going on in Roman history, not Jewish history. I gave an example. Let's go to 1:5. In the days of King Herod of Judea, it's said in Roman history. If you go to chapter 2, in the days a decree went out from Emperor Augustus, Roman. Quirinius was governor of Syria, Roman. Scholars have always been fascinated with that. My goodness, the others would have been horrified by that. You know, let's set it by Moses. Let's set it by some other dating, but not who's on the throne, like Luke does. Again, Romans represent the world. Luke is interested in the empire. He's interested in the whole universe. He's interested in all humankind, and including women. Women were not typically considered part of humankind, if I can put it that radical fashion. It said God created them male and female, but pretty much women were much more property than they were persons. And it has been noted, because it's so obvious, that Luke has an interest and an emphasis on women in his gospel that you do not find as much in the others. Now, let me quickly point out, though, that it's not just the kind of interest and emphasis that we find on women today, which is codified in feminism. That is not Luke. So don't read it back into Luke. It just disturbs me whenever we take a category today and put it on Jesus and call Jesus, for example, a feminist. He was the first feminist. I don't know why we do that. Don't call him a Republican. Don't call him a Democrat. Don't call him a Libertarian. Don't call him a Revolutionary. I heard Angela Davis one time speak at Clemson. I don't know if you remember Angela Davis. She was a big radical out of California during the Vietnam era, and she was going all around speaking. So was Jane Fonda. I heard Jane Fonda speaking. Both of them called Jesus a revolutionary. Well, they meant more Marxist revolutionary type. Don't take our label and put on Jesus. That's very unfair to him. Luke is interested in women because women represent all humankind. They've birthed all humankind. Remember his interest in the birth narratives of Jesus and of the church? Elizabeth, the birth of John. He's very interested in that. He portrays Mary, the mother of Jesus, in a significantly great light. And she's the one who picks up and ponders and treasures these things. She's the one who is there along the way. And in the book of Acts, she's there in the upper room. That leads many to say she was perhaps the first disciple. Not called, but she was the first believer because the angel had come to her and she said this is impossible, and the angel told her that yes it is, but with God this will come about, and she said let it be. That's the response of a faithful person, and she was the first. She's in great light here in Luke's gospel. she, you know, is in. There are women who are, if you go to, let me take you to the end, chapter 23. Chapter 23, verse 49. But all his acquaintances, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. The women are noted specifically for being there at the end, at the crucifixion. And then, of course, you go over to chapter 24. The day after the Sabbath, they go to the tomb, and they're women. And they're listed: Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and the other women who were with them. So the women are faithful. And as I mentioned in the book of Acts, when you open up and you've got that number in the upper room, they're specifically mentioned. That's Luke's universal emphasis. He also includes and specifically has an interest in the poor and the sinful. Those who are oppressed by poverty and oppressed by the power of sin. And further oppressed by people who keep them poor and sinful. Now, don't take our templates and lay it over and read it back into it. Luke is not in the camp with those crying victimhood. These poor victims. We're all victims, you know. The oppressed. He's not crying social injustice, economic oppression, and then using that indignation to try to force society into hope and change, political revolution, equal rights, economic redistribution, or anything like that. That is not what Luke is interested in. And by the way, don't read his account of the early church when they sold and shared their possessions as being this kind of economic redistribution or social equality and all the things that we come up with. That is not Luke's interest. He's interested, though, in those who've been left out. The women have been left out. The poor and the sinful have been left out. And Jesus comes for the whole world. This gospel is for all humankind. And so it opens the door for those who have not been allowed to enter. Again, it's not attacking that door shouldn't have been closed and on and on and on and on and on. And it's not about openness and tolerance and so forth and so on. By the way, all of our terminology and all of our ideology comes packed already. That's why I'm saying don't use it. Try to be open to some fresh terms and some fresh thinking on this. Luke is interested in the universality of Jesus. It's not just for the Jewish people, it's for the whole nation. But that was built into Judaism. And now it's time for that to be fleshed out. It's time for it to be fleshed out among the women, among the poor, among the sinful. Not just for them, and et cetera, et cetera. It's for all humankind. I particularly am fascinated with the story of Zacchaeus in chapter 19 of Luke's Gospel. I've always loved the story, not just simply because I've been a short fellow my entire life. And by the way, I was shorter than I am now at previous years. This is the full height, though, that you're going to get. And I'm always fascinated as a little boy with Zacchaeus because, you know, Zacchaeus couldn't see. Well, I remember being in the crowd at events and would have to be put up on my dad's shoulder to see. I mean, what child doesn't know that? And then going to a theater and sitting behind somebody who's big. You know, I've been oppressed. I understand that there's discrimination against people who are short. Remember, short people have no reason to live? Remember that? Okay. I was offended. by that.
Didn't seem to say, "Lo, I am with you always."
All right, Lo, I'm with you. He's with us short people before he is with anybody else. Well, I love the story of Zacchaeus, but there's a significant verse here, a very significant verse, and that is in verse 9. Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham." In other words, today salvation has come to your house. And in Luke's gospel, it's extremely important that salvation is coming to everyone's house. It's not just for specific houses. It's coming to all houses. It's coming to the house of the poor as well as to the rich. Zacchaeus is the rich. And it's not that, he says, "I'm not going to come to your house until you give up all this money that you've ill-gained." It's not that. He goes to his house. And he's not going there asking for a handout or for some revolution. It's just that as Zacchaeus encounters this one who's come to his house and salvation has come, then his life is redirected and changed and so forth. He comes to the house of the sinful. He comes to the house of the Gentile. He comes to the house of Israel. He comes to the house of women. That's Luke's emphasis. He's come to the house. All houses. Now, in this gospel, Luke is particularly interested in history. And I've already indicated his interest. Not just the history of Jesus, he's interested in placing Jesus in history. Jesus was born. Jesus lived. Jesus was a human being. He was a man of his time. He was a product of his age. Jesus is in history. But he's not interested in either a metaphysics of history, that's pondering what history is, or he's not interested in providing a secular history, such as the Jewish historian Josephus, who would be living at this time in the first century, and from which we get a lot of our knowledge of the first century. And by the way, Josephus's work has been translated into English, and I have a copy. I can't find it, but I've got a copy. And I have used it in the past, but you can read the writings of Josephus. And probably you could Google Josephus and come up with some of excerpts or chapters even out of his writing. But nonetheless, Luke is not trying to be another Josephus. He's not writing secular history. But he's interested in positioning Jesus in history. Not above it or beyond it, but in history. And in Acts, he's interested in presenting the church, positioning it in history, in its time, in its place. That is Luke's interest. But here is Luke's contribution. He writes a history qualified by the eschaton. Should I use my drawing?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Where's my... Time moves on, history moves on, and it was believed that there would be an eschaton. And that is the point of consummation. That's the end. It's not just fini, F-I-N-I-S, the Latin term for finish. Okay, we reached the end of the race, it's over. But rather, it's the end that is the fulfillment. The end purpose for which all of this has been taking place. And that is what we know of by Jesus as the kingdom of God. The new heaven and the new earth. the new creation. The Jews looked at it, you know, and you hear the prophet speaking of shalom, or the day of peace, the day of justice, the day of righteousness, the day of the Lord. All of that is a reference to the same thing, which is the eschaton. And so, it is believed that history is moving to that point. And that one day, righteousness will flow, and one day there will be, you know, it will cover the whole earth. This is a universal kind of thing. This is all of the not just the earth, but the cosmos will be saved. Salvation is referring to this. Salvation is only when the kingdom comes and God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. Only that is salvation. The day of the Lord. Everybody follow me? Everybody tracking? Okay. Now, it is believed in this. This is called an eschatological understanding of history. I could use other terms. This is a theological understanding of history. This is history in relation to God, in relation to the salvation of God. Theological history. It is the story of biblical history, because biblical history is told theologically and eschatologically. This is not secular history. You're not going to read this in a school history textbook. Why not? What's the difference between an eschatological understanding of history and a secular understanding of history?
Secular, it happened. It already finished.
Definitely. That's part of it. It's more than that, but that's part of it. In other words, the past is the past. And we historically look to that and try to uncover something about it. Right?
Well, you don't get the divinity of Jesus from the faith.
Right. Right. Keep going. What's the difference between secular history, which you're going to read in a school textbook, and biblical history? Theological history. Eschatological history.
Secular God.
Right. Secular has no reference to God.
It's not aiming to a point either. It's
right.
It's
right.
Telling what's behind you, but it doesn't right. tell you what's...
Yeah, history tells what's behind it. May tell you a little of what's going on based on a historical perspective and project a little bit, but there's no end. Exactly. In other words, there's nothing luring events to it.
No purpose. No purpose.
No purpose for it. Right. Things happen. Now, we have to interpret the things that happened, but we're trying to do it, you know, by taking the data we have and putting it together. We have an archaeological find of some kind, and we have a coin over here that gave the impression of the emperor, and we try to interpret that. We try to lay it out. And by the way, historians are much more slanted than they tell you, but that's fine. You can't not be. You just simply want to be honest about it and careful about it. But you know, we need secular history. Secular history would have dealt with the Exodus in what way? Kind of how would the story go in secular history?
Just cause and effect.
The king has a bad day.
Pardon?
The king has a bad day.
Yeah, the king has a bad day. I don't know if you heard that. You know, Pharaoh has built a great empire. He's building great buildings, using his slaves people, and... there was a guy named Moses Perhaps they would put that in there, who Moses who came. He said he was from God. We have no way to back that up. And because a lot of people who say that, and that's true. And these people ended up escaping. And Pharaoh went after him, but didn't get them. In fact, he ended up, his armies disappearing off the face of the earth. That's about all we can say. Whereas the biblical story is going to say, Moses was out tending the sheep and the bush burned, and God said, I've heard the oppression of my people. I'm going to send you, and you just say to Pharaoh, let my people go, and I will force his hand, and I will force the deliverance of my people. And then I'm going to send them into the wilderness. This isn't socio-political economic liberation. I'm choosing them. This is election. I'm choosing them to be my people, and I will form them in the wilderness as my people. You can't get that in secular history because historians have much more empirical basis for what they do, not a theological openness to that. The interpretation is not theological and not eschatological. So Luke is not interested in a secular history, but he does want to put the events of the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus in history, and he wants to put the church's life and ministry in history. It is part of the stream of events that historians study, that historians can know. But what they can't study and they can't know as historians is that there is something much greater going on here. There's a greater plan. There's a greater outworking that is of God. And so I'm going to tell the story from that angle. And so he's not wanting to, you know, he's not laying out very much at all the secular history. He's just positioning. But then he's saying, you know, these things happened. There was the birth of Jesus in the year when Quirinus was governor and they called for the tax, and et cetera, et cetera. And that can be backed up by Josephus and others who said, yes, indeed, that took place. That's secular history. But it doesn't tell you, well, so what? Or what does this really mean? Is it part of anything greater? And Luke is saying in his writings, it's part of the eschaton, heading toward the eschaton. That's what this is about. And so it's a qualified history that he's writing, both of Jesus and the church in the book of Acts. It's a qualified history, qualified by the eschaton. It's not limited to secular history. It's connected to, it's part of, but it doesn't even necessarily mean that the historians would recognize it. If the historian is not a Jewish or a Christian believer, he's going to reject it. But there's more going on according to Luke. This is not just another birth. This is not just another organization getting started thinking, you know, that's why I keep telling you all the time, there was not a committee in the upper room developing a long-range strategy for church growth. You know, they didn't say, you know, Pentecost would be a great time. We've got a big audience, and we can put up banners, and I mean clowns and whatever, call attention to it, and we're going to go out there and hit them hard first thing on Pentecost morning. And, you know, we're going to build up momentum, and we're going to do that. That's how we do it. Because we only believe in secular history and can only be a part of secular history. But if God is acting, he can take even a maiden in a young girl in Nazareth and say, by the way, you're going to bear the Son of God. And she says, there's no way I can do that. I haven't known my husband in that way, or my would-be husband. And by the way, she's kind of half-wife. In there, in the way their tradition worked, they kind of had two parts to marriage. The betrothal was really the first step of being married. It's not, again, don't take our patterns. You know, we have pre-engagement and engagement. Now, you could be engaged 20, 30 years, you know. I know someone that happened to. You guys, I want you to go and get married. Well, in a way, in the Jewish way, you are already starting to be married. It's just that you have not lived together. Again, our patterns are not the patterns of that time. And so she's betrothed, which means she's already completed the first part of the marriage to Joseph, but not the second, where she leaves her parents' home and goes and is at his house. Well, you know, she says, you know, history works a certain way. The world works a certain way. And they said, well, I know that, but something else is going on here, and it's going to happen. And she says, okay, let it happen. And so now there's something more, not just secular history or not just secular events. It doesn't mean these are done away with, but in the middle of them, something is done that is about the eschaton. And I'll quickly say this, and we'll come back next week to finish it up. It is believed that the eschaton comes in advance in the person, the life, and the ministry of Jesus. In fact, I believe that this is key to understand the Christian faith. If you don't know this and do not understand this, you do not know and understand the Christian faith. I don't care how many years you've been in the church. And by the way, I grew up never hearing anything about this. Never. But you do not understand Jesus, and you do not understand the church. You do not understand your life if you do not know this. And that's why I just hammer it. I've been hammering it for 30 years. Ever since I first learned it, I went, well, wait a minute. That now makes clear what we believe. But I've just never been taught that and never had heard it. And by the way, most Christians still today don't know it, never heard it. But it is key. It is key to the Christian faith. It is believed that in Jesus, God's future came in advance, broke in, and started saving the world. And, you know, when Jesus says, the kingdom of God is near, that was his message. That's what he's talking about. Repent. That's the only response to this. And so here we are, the church. And, you know, you can look at it as, here's the church in the world, secular. And that's how most people look at it. It's another organization, got another strategy, got another plan, battling all the other ideologies and et cetera, et cetera. And then you go, but wait a minute. What if the kingdom of God has broken in? And what if the kingdom of God has created this church? Then this church is something else. It's not what it appears secularly. And you know that's the message. By the way, if any of you have children, you're probably going, Betty's going to shoot me.
And I think this is what makes Advent so much more meaningful, when you have this understanding of the coming.
Right. It is not, there's this, you know, everybody oohs and ahs over a baby in the middle of the holiday season. That's not what this is about. But if indeed God has, by His Spirit, birthed this one for the inbreaking of His kingdom, His will to be done, to already begin saving the world, now you're talking something so much greater than oohing and awing over a newborn baby. Isn't that sweet? This isn't talking about sweetness. This is talking about salvation. And indeed, that's already begun. And is already in ways that we cannot fathom or certainly control or even know oftentimes. It's changing, transforming the world into God's kingdom. And that's the message of the Christian faith. All right, we'll pick up there next week. Hold that, and we'll finish it up.